I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. I suspect that many of you, to the extent you've attended conferences, know who Sharon Crane is, a gal who's out of the Pacific Group in California and a lovely lady, and her husband is Casey, like K-C, and he just passed away today. And he's been struggling with cancer for a long time. He's just an extraordinary guy. They are a very special couple, so keep them. We might throw that in our minds and hearts a little bit this weekend and just send a little love their way. What is the most unique 12-step call you went on?
I got one, too.
Okay, Sandy will answer that, too. The first one I went on was an 18-hour 12-step call. I was on my white horse, a woman called. I went out and I got two gals that got out of Hazelden, and one of them got home and her husband put a fifth of vodka with a blue ribbon on it on her back step. And so I brought them over to my aunt's house. I worked with them all. I was just trying to save them. One of the things that sticks in my mind so much in that thing, number one, was they asked me why I was sober. Now, you're brand new. You go out. I mean, you could ask questions that are, I'd never been asked that. You know, question. I give enough bullshit that I was able to answer it, but it was a powerful question. I worked with that gal. She was from an upper-class family in St. Paul. She was manic depressive. Remember, I was, it's the only woman I've ever worked with, and I didn't work with her as a sponsor. I just couldn't get unconnected with her. And she ended up going to prison. Her father committed suicide. She lost her children. It was just one of the most tragic, bloody processes. I've been chased out of a place with a gun. I've been in a fight. I've punched a guy to keep him in the hospital. I shouldn't tell the story. I got into a sort of a fist fight with my father on a 12-step call. My father was over drinking one night. My father developed alcoholism very late in life. And they called me and they were having an upset at the house, and I got in my car, speeded. I mean, I was driving 70 miles an hour from West St. Paul to the house to be this, you know, asshole. Just to go call. My father and I got in a car, and my father and I did not have a great pattern of communication with each other, and he ended up starting and then I remember going to one of the old timers, and he said, "What in the fart are you doing? You are not to talk to your father about this subject. We will now take over, and you will get the hell out of the way."
Way back when, and I should have known better, but I was fairly new, an airline pilot called the intergroup. No, the pilot's wife called. And she said, "My husband's an airline pilot. He's an alcoholic, and he's in his den, and he's been shooting holes in the ceiling of his den, and we need some help." So the desk called me because I was a pilot, and they said, "We need you to go see this pilot." So I just went. You never go alone. So I get there, and then I hear what's going on. And so I don't know why, but I decided to knock on the door and go in. And so the guy said, "Yeah," and he's sitting behind the desk. And he was very cordial and all that, and I sat down and I said, "I understand you might have a drinking problem, and I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I flew for the Marine Corps, and I'm doing, oh yeah, what'd you fly? Well, I did this and that." And he said, "I just don't think I have a problem with my drinking. I'm still employed, I'm still that." And I'm going, "Well, I was looking at these bullet holes in your ceiling, and it seemed unusual to shoot bullets in your own den in the ceiling." And he said, "Well, that won't happen again. I'm fine. And I left. I never saw him again. He's probably still flying somewhere. These things don't have happy endings all the time. They just are very bizarre. But anyway,
you're up.
I'm up. What a funny question. How do you keep yourself realistic when aiming for perfection without being too hard on yourself? If I play golf, I know I'll never be Tiger Woods no matter how hard I try. That's the trick, is to set a goal that you know you'll never reach and be happy with that and not be frustrated by it. That you are going to see, in other words, you're basically saying, I'm going to see how close I can get to my higher power. And don't feel frustrated that you don't seem to have made any progress, that you don't, in other words, this, when Bill put that in the sixth step, he wanted to raise our eyes up so that we stop settling for semi-good and move on. And the only way to do that is to put it up there so that it's unreachable, but you're going to try anyway. And for people who get frustrated by things like that, this is a new venture in open-mindedness, which is what he calls it. So if you know ahead of time that you're not going to get there and you're still going to try, it should take out some of the frustration.
I'd like to speak to that too, if I could. Because we sobered up when we did, we have been, and because we started talking as early as we have, we've been exposed to what I think are some of the most extraordinary people in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long period of time. I could take 10 people on that list, from Chamberlain to White to my sponsor to other people. They were extraordinary in their recovery and extraordinary in their development. And they were very human. There wasn't a one of them that didn't have flaws. There wasn't a one of them that didn't have quirks. You could have talked to some of their children and the children might be unhappy with them. They're, I mean, they were human beings doing an extraordinary job. Some of them, we were the benefactors of their unbelievable contribution and they paid a price in the work area of their life or other, some other area of their life. There just aren't any perfect people. I think one of the great, my sponsor is a mailman, was a mailman. If you would have had, you would not have invited him this weekend to give you a teaching on the big book. But he was my big book. He was the perfect guy for me. He was a hell of a 12-stepper. He never gave me poor advice. He was just solid. And I needed someone to calm me down. I vibrated when I came in. And so I like that the book says that we trudge the road of happy destiny. It doesn't say we trudge the road to happy destiny. We are travelers. We are seekers. We are journey. We're on a journey together. And we're talking about our experiences on the journey. And I don't think we ever arrive. Mm-hmm. I think it's that. Is it ever necessary to say you will not work with someone who is asking for help? Yeah, I say no. I don't know how correct it is or incorrect it is. I get asked a lot by people who are out of town. You give a talk and someone gets taken with your talk and they want you to sponsor them or do brain surgery after the meeting or, you know, do something, you know. Because they're caught in the emotion and the experience. They connected with you and they want to, you know, it's not... I'm always a little suspicious when people from out of town. I think once people have a fair amount of sobriety, the out of town thing is a possibility, depending upon how well you connect. But there's something wrong with me when a person comes up and says they can't find anybody in their area. You know, I mean, I worry about that sometimes. Either they're not going to enough meetings, or they've got some sort of way of seeing things that they can't appreciate some of the wonderfulness. And they're looking for a perfect guy. And for 45 minutes, I look pretty good, you know. So I do. I have had people, I have had three or four people that I've gotten too close to over a period of time, and I was working with them at the level of the problem rather than the level of the solution. I don't know what it was. I cared too much, or and one of them, I've separated myself from that relationship. And whenever I've separated myself from that relationship, I said, I want to be clear. I want to be friends. What we're doing isn't working. We're having personal conversations that you're not using me as I would like to be used. And you're not talking to me about some of the stuff that's going on. And you need to find someone who you will have the conversations that are necessary for your recovery. And I want to remain friends. This is not like being fired. This is, I don't know, whatever word you would use. In the earlier days, you never fired a sponsor. I mean, I just didn't ever hear of it. And it happens a lot today.
Just my own experience, I don't sponsor anybody I don't see at meetings that I go to, at least one or two a week. So I don't do out of town or anything like that. And however, people at conferences and stuff, and they say, well, could I call you? And I go, yeah, if you have a specific spiritual question or problem, I'll be glad to answer it. No small talk. You don't call me up just to shoot the crap at 11 o'clock at night. And I'm a very private person. I have a very limited number of friends. When I'm in the hospital, no visitors. I mean, it looks like I'm ha, 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 ha. But I'm, right? I'm just...
I'm more of that.
I don't share personal stuff except with very close friends. You know what I'm saying? So I'm an introvert who's masquerading as an extrovert. Oh, I love this. This is for me. You said let go and let God are the four key words. Isn't that five words? Wait a minute. Yeah, I'm wrong. I am totally wrong. I love whoever wrote that.
It was an Al-Anon.
Oh, it was an Al-Anon.
Sorry.
I feel God is calling me to do his work outside of AA. I am grounded in all the spiritual principles. However, I am not spending much time in AA at the moment. Is this dangerous? I would really ask your sponsor, because they can see your energy and see whether you're centered and solid. But as long as we're staying close to God and we're helping people, I feel we're doing fine. There are people who come to AA and become a minister. They get sober. They fall in love with God. They become a minister. And they're ministering to non-alcoholics and alcoholics in their congregation. And, that's where they were called. So it's not like you got to run over there and say, you're no longer a good AA member. I mean, good Lord. Look what they're doing. And so... of course, we have a general thing that if you start drifting away from AA into a non-spiritual activity, it's probably going to be risky. But something like this, and if your sponsor's at sitting with you, says, yeah, you're nice and centered, I'd be comfortable with that and as can be.
Today, AA has become so big, you can almost live your entire life in AA. The measure of what it is to be a good AA is not just the measure of what you do inside Alcoholics Anonymous. It is how you are with your family, how you are with your work, how you are with your extended group of people that you interact with. It is And I think sometimes we talk almost too much about just what we do inside Alcoholics Anonymous. But there is something that we provide each other in the support system and our focus on the fact that it is a disease and people are at risk, even if they've been sober a considerable period of time. So absencing yourself entirely from something that saved your life and is so critical to the core, I would always worry if the person was not active at all, if they were going to meetings and had a sponsor, but most of their work was outside AA, that wouldn't bother me a lot. But if they did not have a sponsor and they were not going to meetings on a regular basis and were really disconnected with AA, I would have a concern that a person could move that far away from the core that brought them to the fullness of their life. How to become truly reliant on God and truly believe that everything will be as it should. I love the word that the word is believe. If you could talk to the wisest people in the world, I think that most of them would tell you that it's okay the way it is. And it doesn't matter a hell of a lot what you believe. We don't care much in Alcoholics Anonymous about what you believe. I think that's one of the great strengths of spirituality is not focused as much on belief as it is on experience. I think our beliefs interfere with our relationship with God. I think most of us have to alter and broaden our idea of a higher power in order for us to get the reliance and to want to. Someone came up not too long ago and said, oh, I've got a lot of work to do. But she said it in a joyful way. You know, and that's what we're discovering this weekend. I mean, we should want, you know, as we start to do this is an opportunity. This isn't about what you should do. This isn't about good, you want the correct way to do it. This is about making your life more full. This is about finding some joy and peace. Happiness, which is a word we throw around a lot, totally, I mean, he says happiness when we use it in common sense, is a word that usually is related to circumstances being pleasant. But joy and peace are not related necessarily to circumstances being pleasant. And we have a program which, regardless of what the circumstances that are going on in our lives, allow us an opportunity to have a place to stand where there is peace and there is joy and there is mental peace, mental contentment.
Yeah, that was great. Keep going.
You sound surprised.
Not that surprised. Oh, well. How do I get past and forgive my brother who raped my stepdaughter when she was 15? Can I withhold forgiveness? Is that what that says? What do you think that says? Can I without?
Yeah, withhold forgiveness, yes.
Can I withhold forgiveness?
Could you talk about your experience?
Tomorrow?
Thank you.
Of course you can withhold forgiveness. That's how you stay in pain. And then we take the subject matter and elevate it. See, this is not somebody who ripped off a poker game and took $20. This is a much higher level wrongdoing. So we can get a lot of support to justify not forgiving. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yeah, there's forgivable, but then there's stuff up at this higher level where you can't forgive. And when we do that, that means we're going to sentence ourselves to a lifetime of suffering because we won't forgive, because we've judged it as not forgiving. Now, when I was new, it wasn't anything at this level. It was trivial stuff that I thought, well, why would I forgive that and why would I do that? And I was complaining to my sponsor. about, you know, why should I forgive and all that, and that, you know, how far do you carry this damn thing? And he said, oh, you know, let me just tell you, you know, there was this guy, and they were nailing him to a cross. And he was going to die a horrible death. And he said, forgive them. They know not what they do. So if you have something happen to you that's worse than being nailed to a cross, come on back and we'll talk about it. Come on back and we'll talk about it. So it seems that forgiveness is at that level. To err is human, to forgive is divine. There is no category of anything that can't be forgiven. It's not condoned. It's just we are forgiving. As Bob was saying, Chuck said, the guy who's out doing this is doing the best that he can. If he was closer to the light, that wouldn't happen. And so, yes, you can withhold forgiveness, but you do it at your own suffering. That's the forgiveness is for us. And when we do that, we feel God just loving us for doing it. We just feel Him just loving us for forgiving. You might be the only one in your family that forgives. The only one. And I'll talk some more about this tomorrow. I had a few of these things last year.
You sure did. Is there a way to bring a non-alcoholic through the steps? How? Absolutely. You know, use the book. Use the same workbook, same process that we go through, and have them put, if they, you know, one of the workbooks that I've looked at talked about putting your own lack of recovery or your own problem area of your life in where they would put alcohol. And in whatever context, you know, if the you have to have some sort of context, I think, to start a spiritual process like that. So you would have to define why you are about to attempt to go through this. So if I'm attempting to go through it to be closer to God or to increase my spiritual understanding or to improve my life, I would be, instead of alcoholism, I would be putting in, you know, my lack of spiritual development, my misunderstanding of the way I see life, something like that. But absolutely, I mean, Bill talks about, you know, I think this book has merit for all sorts of people.
Along those lines, many, many years ago up in D.C., I had a Saturday morning deal with going through the steps, and we had a lot of fun and raffled off potted mums. It's a kind of a goofy little morning, but we were over in the auditorium at the National Institute of Health, NIH, and it was a great big auditorium, and at that time, there were a lot of Hare Krishnas in the airports. You remember them? They'd be around trying to get money and blah, 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 blah. So I looked down the front row and there's four Hare Krishnas sitting there. And I'm saying to myself, non-judgmentally, of course, if these guys think they're going to get some money out of this AA group, you know, who are these things? Hi, everybody. Who are they? You know, and so I'm talking all that, and they're gone. So I said to one of the guys, you know, that helped with the meeting, I said, did you get those Hare Krishnas? He said, I don't know who they were. They're gone. And, well, we probably won't see them. We go, burp, next week, there they are. And I still didn't get a chance to talk to them. So the following week, they're back, but they didn't stop and talk to anybody. They weren't trying to get it. So I go down and I stop the guys. It was like six. And there may have been a couple of gals in there. I don't know, but they had the little outfits and all that. And I said, who are you people? Out of curiosity. And he said, oh, we're from the Buddhist prayer center outside of town. And our Lama came across these steps and felt that we were stuck at a certain level and that we should try these steps for a year. And somebody told us about you and this meeting and all that, so we're down here to, and I said, really? I didn't even know they had a prayer center out there or whatever. So we had this nice long conversation, et cetera. And about 6 months later, they called me up and they said, we have a 12-step meeting out here. And it's a discussion meeting. Would you like to come out and lead it? And I said, yeah. So I came out there and I was, holy cow, this place was so spiritual. The garden and everything was just, you know, arranged perfectly. You walked in the meditation room and it was, you could just feel all the energy. And they were in the kitchen. They're all sitting cross-legged. They had more serenity in that room than all the meetings of AA combined. And they had typed up the steps, and the difference was in step one it says we're powerless over life's problems, and our life became unmanageable. And other than that, they went through all this, and they were getting tremendous benefits out of it and all that. So I said to them, afterward, I said, how did your lama come across this thing? And they said, oh, she saw it in the paper one day. And of course, being a chauvinist, I went, there's a female lama in the... And so they showed me her picture. She was a housewife from New York City who read about somebody had been over here, one of the gurus from India, and she went over to India and achieved enlightenment, and she was the first American lama in the Buddhist prayer center. But I never got to meet her. I just read about her and saw that. So when we say, can this work for anything? Boy, it sure did there.
Our son Peter, who's sober 20 years. I know his name, I'm just not sure of the time. I have. So he was out, he was this horrible little kid who went to five colleges, went out, finally got a degree in film, worked out in the West Coast, and he got stuck, decided to reinvent himself, and he ended up in Oxford University getting an MBA. As an interim study, he went to work with the Dalai Lama's organization in Dharamsala. And he ended up making a film with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and Deepak Chopra on spirituality called Beyond Our Differences. And while they were discussing this project, which we were going to give to the Dalai Lama for his 70th birthday, he's with this number two guy, this Tenzin Gyatso, and he's in the office, and they're discussing what's wrong with the different spiritual movements, or not, but this man said, the problem that we all have, he says, that there is conflict among the different traditions. And Peter looked over, and on this guy's desk was a big book. And Peter looked over and grabbed the book and held the book up and says, this organization tries not to do that. And that led to a conversation about the problem with alcohol within the Tibetan community, and that led to Peter initiating the translation of the big book into Tibetan, which is just completed last year. And it, I mean, just the accident of how things happen. And that may be the only reason Peter was in India.
Wow, Bob, what a great story. You had to top me again, didn't you? I had a little prayer group. You had the Dalai Lama. Okay. I know Frank Buckman's grandson. Okay. How do I summon the willingness and courage to let go and forgive parents who abandoned me as a child? I now, elderly, showed up in my life. I don't know. I now, again, after 40 years old, sick, frail, now need my help. How do I try to rethink and see differently the story of my past to do the right thing and help them? Is your real name Sandy Beach? No, it's a nickname, Richard. Okay, so this obviously is a tremendous spiritual opportunity, and I think whoever wrote this already sees that somehow they're being called upon to jump way over the limit that they have previously ever achieved, and to actually go and love and help, and this will be a tiring experience. It could go on for a long time. Do I have the resources inside of me to let go of all the old negative feelings and actually be the one that tries to help them in through these last years? And so the question really is an inventory inside of ourselves. Is there that kind of a person inside of me or not? And I think this person already suspects that there is. And you ought to just be so happy to find that out. It makes me so happy to see a question like this. I mean, this is, whoever came here, when you came here, you were another selfish drunk like the rest of us, and now you're entertaining something at this level? Even to consider it is a very beautiful thing, so we love you.
How vital was the application of the mechanics, orthodoxy of discipline, step work, upon which your full-blown spiritual stem from, and what life experience paved the way to be key in your own transformation into a higher consciousness and faith? How vital was the application of the mechanics, orthodoxy? I believe that our big book was divinely inspired. The fact that a man with 4 years of sobriety wrote that book, and that we have been reading that book for 75, or, you know, since 1939, 73, 72 years, and every time I picked the nature of real spiritual literature is that when you go to read it and you're in a good place, it's always new. It's always new. And every time I pick that book up, when I'm not just perfunctory reading it, there's something new. There's something different. There's a different focus. So as far as orthodoxy goes, to the extent I am a student and a reader of our big book in the 12 and 12. So if, to that extent, that would be orthodox. To then take that into making people right and wrong, I think is ego and intellect. I think it has to do with belief, and I don't think it's spiritual. That said, I know a lot of people who are a hell of a lot more militant about the book, who I think are great members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who have great sponsor chains, who do a hell of a lot of 12-step work. And I think some of them, if you know, when I wouldn't be surprised if I met some of them 15 years from now that they softened. They might not. I don't know. Don't have to. I don't have an opinion. It's not my job. Some of them are a hell of a lot better 12-steppers and do a hell of a lot more work than I do and so forth. You can't do it without attending to the real work, and the real work is described in our text. But that is, as I talk about, it's an inside job, it's a change of heart. You put yourself in that position, you start doing what looks like the mechanics of the work, and inside of that, you have a spiritual experience. That is personal, it is different, it is not mechanical, it is not orthodox, it is what it is. What paved the way for that? My failure paved the way for me to be able to attend to that process. More than anything else, my failure in my drinking brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my failure in the different areas of my life ongoing and my inability to make the progress that I would like to make has driven me back to the book and the steps on an ongoing basis.
Amen. And I'm a big believer in following precisely what the book instructs us to show the new person how to recover. It's no deviation from that. And so if we gave the impression that we're not following exactly as we believe it's laid out, why that's wrong. And it's, I'm sure for the new person I'm sponsoring, they're going, give me a break, you know, and they probably tell everybody I'm a Nazi sponsor and I'm the kindest guy in the world. It's just ridiculous because they're going to have to go through painful ego puncturing and they're going to have to be told they're wrong and shut up and all the things. Only I don't see it that way. I think I'm being nice while I'm saying all those things. How harmful does harm need to be to require a verbal amend? Some people make amends for every little comment and every cold look. Where do I draw the line? Well, obviously, we could carry this to an extreme. Just for the heck of it, I guess. Did I offend you with that look? I'm sorry. You know. I would say, again, if some action you did bothers you, there's the measuring thing. I shouldn't have said that, even though it looks like it didn't bother them at all. It still bothered you. In other words, it's on your plate. Now, do you have to make a big production out of it? Sometimes in these small things, it can wait until there's a conversation. Maybe you're having dinner, there's some people sitting around, and you just go as if it was a coincidence that you thought it up. You know, I used some pretty hard language last week when I was talking to you. I probably should have said this. It doesn't even look like you're making an amendment. You didn't make a formal occasion out of it. You follow what I'm saying? But you found a way to say out loud that I feel I made a transgression in something, the way I said something or looked or whatever. But I didn't make a federal case out of going to make the amend, you know, I'd like to show up, I need a couple hours, this and that. I found a way of, during a meeting or after a meeting, of sliding it into the conversation, and I think that's sufficient.
Two Sundays ago, I was at an AA function, and I got my feelings hurt. It was at a planning meeting or whatever for this big roundup that we were having that I founded with another guy and got mistreated and embarrassed and dumped all over someone and had to go make amends to three different people. It was really fun. Do I need to confess to the police on me in order to clean up my part? Probably not enough information. I would say with a very strong, not necessarily. I don't know why. The biggest amend that obviously you could make is to conduct your life in a way that you are not doing anything that is ongoingly illegal. I do not see the benefit. You didn't harm the police. You harmed, I don't know what action that the person took. But on the face of it, my quick answer to that question would be no. And I'd like to know more about, you know, what the facts are in the situation to answer more intelligently.
I have a story about that that is just sort of related that I love telling because it's such a powerful thing about the ninth step. And it was, I heard it from the guy who was talking from the podium, and he was the sponsor. And he said, I was sponsoring a guy who, after a while, came to me and said, I left something off my eighth and ninth step. He said, during the years that I was using alcohol and drugs, I broke into 9 homes over, you've heard this story, over in this neighborhood, and took TVs and stuff and hocked it in order to get the money. Should I go back and make amends to those people? Because if I do, they're liable to call the cops and I'll go to jail. And so that's a tough question. And the sponsor said, Well, let's not do it and see if you can live with it. A year later, the guy came back and said, I have to go see the people. I can't live with it. And the sponsor said, I'll go with you. And we'll go at dinner time. And they made sure he had $50. And he went up and knocked on the door and said, I'm the guy who broke in here 4 years ago. If you want to call the cops, I'll stand here and wait while they come. But I just want to tell you that I was stealing it to buy alcohol. I'm in AA now. I have 4 years sobriety. And I'd like to make amends. And I can give you $50 now and whatever amount you want. I will somehow make monthly payments and work out something. But it's essential that I get this off my chest. And about half the people didn't want anything. They were astounded that this guy would come up. And they never were treated like that before. Others, there was one angry guy, and he said, well, I'm thinking of calling, but all right, I want $500. And the guy said, okay. And he made monthly payments, $50 a month for 10 months, and paid that guy off. And they got to the last house, and the woman answered the door, and he told the woman, what the story was and that he wanted to make amends. And she said, you already have. You come in and tell my husband what you just told me. And he went in and told her husband that I'm the guy that broke in. And the husband was starting to cry. And he said, until you came, we thought our son did it, had been lying about it all these years. And so he straightened out that family. And that story could have been that person number six called the cops and he had to serve a year or whatever it is. But some of those things, you just repeat the story. So that's all I'm doing. It doesn't answer it, but it's...
Which one addressed to you?
Oh, addressed to me.
Yeah, you can do it next time.
Why don't you even read it?
How do you define what constitutes an injury for except one to do so when injured or other part of step nine is emotional upset injury. I think if you use common sense in prayer and discuss it with your sponsor and maybe rehearse about how you would have the conversation with the person so that the likelihood is that you would be clear that you're focusing on your side of the street. If pretty much if we stay on our side of the street, what we can absolutely control what the response would be. But I think if you're nervous about it in a particular situation, I just make darn sure that you discuss it with a couple of people, pray about it, and rehearse what you would say, because a lot of us are not very skilled when we get in, and when we get into a family and other sorts of conversations, they can get, you know, there's a lot of conditioning in those conversations, and we can fall into patterns that are mischievous very quickly and almost automatically.
Okay, Sandy, if you can, would you speak to the importance of immediately and prompt amends to our family members, especially children, because they may leave us, please? People assume we have a lifetime to do this. P.S., my 21-year-old son was killed when I was a year and a half sober, but by making amends to him early, it became a faithful blessing. And I think this is a wonderful thing to discuss, because we do have stories about AA members who get up and go, I was so sad that I didn't make amends to my father and he died. And so they try to make graveside amends. And so whoever wrote this, this is in that same category, is that there are people on the list, and especially family members. And so you want to go there as soon as possible. There's such a thing as going too soon. In other words, if you've just been sober a week and you go over to your 21-year-old son and go, son, I'm here to make amends for all the damage I did, and you've got a week sobriety, it just isn't credible. It's almost impossible for them to believe that you're a transformed person. And so it may serve a surface purpose, but you also may get a blast. Whereas if you have a year, this, and they know it, they know that you have now made these transformations, it's a different ball game when you sit down and, you know, and you say, you know, I've been sober a year now, and I'm in the program, and I'm really learning from other members of AA how much harm I really did. I had no idea. And I want to sit down and really talk about this. And suddenly, you're a grown-up. You're not a grown-up with a weak sobriety. And so there's that factor. But I also fully appreciate the questioner's point that the people aren't going to be there forever. So work with your sponsor and get to the point as soon as you can.
If steps 4 and 5 start a relationship with yourself and 8 and 9 build a relationship with others, what are steps 6 and 7? I think all of those 6 steps contain the benefit of cleaning up and healing and the relationship with ourselves, with God, and other human beings. Specifically, the fifth step specifically says that, and I think it is inherently contained in all those other steps. Our whole motivation, why we would be doing something so difficult, contains God in that process, and we are healing in the process of building, you know, of healing those relationships with other people. So I think our relationship with ourselves, with our God, and other human beings are contained in all 6 of those steps.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I agree. Whatever you say, Bob. Dear Sandy, did you ever share with the pilot in Brentwood that you were seconds away from ejecting? Although the plane didn't eject, what was his response? We have had long talks about that. He had no idea that I thought he was a radar guy and that I was seriously considering leaving him alone flying the plane. And even though he'd been around alcoholics in AA, he was astounded that I was still flying the Crusader with a hand on the ejection seat. So this guy, he is really great, and we've spent a lot of time reminiscing. Well, actually, he does the reminiscing, and I go, oh, really?
How do you explain to a newcomer people laughing while they tell their story? I don't think we have to. I think most newcomers get it. I just, you know, we're able to laugh about things that we used to cry about, and explaining is an intellectual thing. When they sit in a room and are part of the audience and part of the experience of people being able to laugh about those parts of their lives, they're part of it. They get it. And they may not get it all. It may seem a little bit awkward, but I think it's one of the most powerful things we have in our fellowship, and it's experiential.
We're going to make it. We're coming down to, I've got about 6 left, and we're going to make it before the clock runs out. Oh boy, I love this one. Let's settle once and for all the recovered versus recovering.
He's recovered, I'm recovered.
Oh boy, this is why I love AA. Because we have situations that can't be resolved. We're going to have to exist with the frustration of having people around us who insist the correct answer, you can't be recovered, you're recovering. And then somebody else goes, well, when you have a spiritual awakening, you're recovered. And the book says recovered, but I think recovering. And so it's very clear there's no answer to that question.
How does self-will prevent God from directing my life? Completely.
Yes? Shorter answers are better, aren't they? Bam! What is your current 10th and 11th step practice? I'm going to talk about the 10th step tomorrow and really try to give you some insight into it, if you could wait, because I want to use all the stuff that happened to me last year as a springboard for that. But I will go back and I can't emphasize enough outside reading. The big book in the 12 and 12 in the 11th step encourage us to go to our libraries. They're full of wonderful things. There are teachers. There's all these things. We're not leaving AA. We're enhancing our appreciation of each of the points that's made in AA. And so I'm a big fan of that. And it's as simple, if you've never done it before, just go to a New Age bookstore and stop pulling books off the shelf. I don't relate to that guy. And pull another one. Oh, hey, wait. Now you got a new friend. And if somebody gives you a spiritual book and you go, oh, I don't think so, put it on your shelf. 5 years later, you go, wow, this is cool. That's the same guy you thought was a jerk when you read him 5 years earlier. But they're all to give a different perspective on seeing the same thing. It's just a marvelous thing.
This may be a dangerous question because the mind may run with it, but I am curious what each of you have had personal experiences with in relationship to spiritual teachers, spiritual religious path for Sandy and Bob. Again, we'll probably talk more about that tomorrow. Raised Catholic. I have done an enormous amount of outside work and outside reading. Eastern reading is probably... Eastern reading is probably comprises a considerable portion of what I do, but a lot of what I read is in Christianity also and so forth. I have had a spiritual advisor for about 20 years. My sponsor is 91 years old, and our relationship is more like a father and a son. For the last 15 years, it's been more that. I have four or five people, one of which I'm sitting with here. But I have two or three guys that I check in regularly with to try to maintain some sort of reporting responsibility as to what's going on in my life. When you run into people who you really respect and feel are on the same path, I usually do a 5-minute dump, just kind of checking in so that, you know, you get a sense of how your life's going. And frankly, once you reach a certain point, the different textures aren't that important. I mean, they just, as they were earlier, although I've had a couple of big ones in the last year. It's the most important thing that I do. I really try to have people in my life that I can have the conversation that we're having this weekend. It is just what my life's about. And in saying that, I still am a father, I still am a husband, I still have work responsibilities and other things that I do, but this is the center of my life.
I've had a few outside of AA spiritual teachers that I really, really connected with, and Eckhart Tolle was one of them, and not just reading, but getting some CDs. The guy is just so funny, and he makes you laugh at yourself. He's in New York, and he's going out to give a lecture, and people are walking down the street so fast, he can hardly keep up with them, because he comes from a part of the country where you don't walk that fast. And so he's getting pushed along, and he's going, God, everybody's really in a hurry. I wonder where they're going that is so important that we get there. And after he's there a week, he said, I figured out where they're going. They're in a hurry to get to the next moment because the present moment isn't satisfactory, but it's going to be shortly. And I'm going, what's he, read my mail? And he just leads you into this whole thing about how starting when you were younger, you know, when you were in grammar school. You said, boy, when I get out of grammar school, it's really going to be great because everybody look at high school, they're all over. And you get in high school and you go, well, this doesn't work. This isn't where the hell it is. Wait till I get out of high school. I get in college. Wait till I get married. Wait till we have a kid. Wait till I get promoted. Wait till I get that. And he says, we never stopped to seriously inventory the present moment. So when somebody comes up and says, I'm just not happy, I said, what if you're wrong? And they never heard that question. I said, what if you're wrong? What if you really are happy and you're wrong? Have you ever stopped to look? And then, well, let's look and sit down and let's just really see. You look happy to me. I think you're happy. You have this conversation. And wouldn't that be the most wonderful thing? And go, holy cow, I am happy.
And he talks about running from our past to our future, which is our redemption. And never spending time in the moment. We're always chasing the thing that's going to make it okay. How do you take sponsees through 6 and 7? Mostly they take themselves through 6 and 7 in the process after we do the 4th and 5th step, and then ongoingly the relationship as the problems arise in their lives. I think the discussion about how most of us approach the issues have very much to do ongoingly with steps 6 and 7, and it becomes one of the larger conversations in our relationship. It is astounding to me. I had a couple of guys in the last 2 or 3 years ago that were just real strong soldiers in Alcoholics Anonymous that just went nuts. One tried to kill himself. And one had an affair, midlife crisis. I would no more have predicted that, and it was as if that person had never been in AA. And I was going to fire him, and he said, well, it's just like you leave me at the worst time of my life. I said, you're lying to me. He said, of course I'm lying to you. He said, that's what people who have affairs do. And I said, I feel like I'm not helping you. And I said, the only thing I have in our relationship that I need is for you to listen to me as if there's something important in the discussion that we're having, and I feel like that's missing. And I I'm feeling, but I said, what blows my mind is that you're 20-some years sober. I said, are you asking yourself what God would have you do? I mean, I would not know in the conversation we're having that you're an AA guy. Somewhere, when your pants catch on fire, you've got to have that question somewhere in the deal, or it's almost as if you're not in the game. And when I couldn't get that, and he's back fine, centered and with his wife and doing the deal, and you know, I mean, he's just fine. But I was a basket case for some time.
I remember, yeah. One other, I mentioned Eckhart Tolle, one other was an AA guy who passed away 3 years ago. We were just talking about him, Scott Redman. And if you can get a hold of his tapes, you asked me who influenced me, and he's a lot younger than I am, had a lot less sobriety, but man, and he and I, Bob had seen us, where Scott and I are doing the same thing, and I just could hardly wait to hear his answer to the question. It was so different. And so that's another person. Last question. Oh, boy. I got this one. I've read that my troubles are of my own making, but it sure seems like they're coming from the outside me. Please. Please explain. That is one of the great, it's in our literature about 4 times. So we think our troubles of our own making. And of course it looks like it's coming from the outside. You don't think we'd deliberately make a problem for ourselves, do you? Anyway, this is the way I like to look at that. What is trouble? What is a problem? Now you could say, well, a problem is Your wife goes and leaves you, or the problem is you just got fired, or the problem is that this happens. And I would go, yes, but that's technically not the definition of a problem. A problem is something that's bothering you. Okay? Has anybody got a problem today that isn't bothering you? Have you got one that's not bothering you? I don't see any hands going up. So no one has a problem that's not bothering them. Okay? So what the literature talks about, it disturbs us. That's what the problem did. It disturbed us. So I'm going to, whoever asked this question, I said, if we could find a way where you're not being bothered by this, is it still a problem? So, nothing forces us to get upset over it. We choose to get upset over it. Do you see what I'm saying? We assume that everybody else would get upset over it, and therefore you must get upset over it. But when we're new, you just take the newspaper out and start reading and see how long it is that you just created a problem for yourself. What are the Democrats doing? Do you see what I mean? And you just decided that this story on page 3 is a problem. I read it, and it didn't bother me at all. So is that a problem? So in other words, that came from the outside. My whole point is that I decided and judged that it shouldn't have happened. And therefore, I'm going to get upset over it. I'm the one that decided to get upset over it. And that's how the problem gets made by me. We assume that you're supposed to get upset over it. That you wouldn't be a good human being unless you got upset over it. And back in the material world, when you go in the bar and you tell the people about it, you're gonna damn right, I don't blame you for being upset. I'd go kill the guy. And we got a lot of positive reinforcement to stay angry. And, whoa, holy cow, that, yeah, he is a jerk. Now we come in AA and we go, well, look, you're going to have to forgive him. What? Yeah, because the new name of the game is being undisturbed. And we'll talk about that in the 10th step. And so this is why Bill is saying we're the ones who decided that this shouldn't have happened. And the answer is, but it did happen. And so we find that we can get out of the whole game by making the priority being undisturbed. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. But that's where that phrase comes from. So we're at the end of the time. Wonderful questions. Unbelievable questions. I wish the answers were as good. And we'll get instructions on when we come back.
We got...